Hi, I'm Coach John Cook, and this is the Basketball and Life podcast. Thanks for listening to today's episode. From the very beginning of this podcast, the first intro leading into episode one, it was pretty clear that this podcast was destined to be about people and their basketball stories. And that's much of what the podcast has been about. A lot of our guests have been coaches, and most of them will continue to be. But it's not fair to assume that people who haven't coached at the highest levels of high school or in college, or like some of our other guests, don't have a passion for basketball and an interesting story and a lifetime committed to the game and a lifetime impacted by the game. And today's guest is Jim Clay. Jim was the one-time director of AAU basketball in Van Wert and became a director for the American Youth Basketball Tour and spent 52 years involved in basketball, whether it was coaching at the youth levels, even coaching high school basketball, and then running events and running tournaments. I don't know a person with a greater passion for basketball and who believes that his life maybe has been more impacted by the game than Jim Clay. And that's why I think his story is worth telling. Also because Jim is a guy that helped me get my start in coaching, being involved with AAU basketball in Van Wert when I was probably 17 or 18 years old. Coaching kids that were 10, 11, 12, 13-year-old basketball players. Jim's association, his organization, allowed me the opportunity to get involved in coaching. And when I saw recently that Jim had decided to step away from everything, that AYBT was kind of winding down and he was officially going to retire from basketball, it just felt like the right thing to do to reach out to Jim and have this conversation. I hope you enjoy my visit today with Jim Clay. My guest today is Jim Clay. If you are a Northwest Ohio person, you probably are very, very familiar with Jim Clay. If you're not, I'm not exactly sure, Jim, how to even do the intro. For me, Jim Clay was the Van Wert AAU guy that helped me get my coaching career started. And for a lot of people, Jim Clay is the AYBT guy. And somewhere between the beginning of your interest in basketball and being the AYBT guy, there's a story in there that I'm looking forward to telling people. How are you tonight?
I'm doing great, John. How are you?
I think I'm good. This is going to be a lot of fun for me because you and I have talked, I don't know, it's not something that we do frequently, but it seemed like annually for about six or seven summers in a row, we would talk.
I think I see you about once a year.
Yeah. We would talk at an event here or there about the summertime every year. And it never got too far away from me from the fact that when I was about 16 or 17 years old and knew that coaching was what I wanted to do, I had a family friend that helped me get involved with the beginnings of what I would have called AAU basketball. And you were in Van Wert and we practiced at the Y. And I mean, that's literally how I came to be aware of who you are. And that's how our paths crossed. And that's how I knew you for a long time before things kind of transitioned to the AYBT thing. And let me be, I hope not the first person, but let me for the first time on this podcast, just say to you, thank you for all of the ways that you chose to make basketball available and affordable and enjoyable for a lot of people.
Appreciate that. I assume you're talking about our old friend Randy Jones.
I am. Randy was the guy that Randy had a son who he thought was going to be a pretty good player, and that his son was about 4 or 5 years younger than me, and he knew I wanted to coach, and he said, "Hey, if I can put together a team with Trevor on it, will you coach it?" And I thought at 16, I thought, "Hell yeah, I'll coach anything right now if you can get me started." And that was the first time I heard your name. He said, "There's a guy in Van Wert named Jim Clay." He said, "I'll try to work through that, and I'll get you guys introduced." And that's how it started.
Yeah, I remember those days so well. We had a lot of young kids that coached, a lot of high school kids that were interested in coaching and got their start doing that.
So you texted me recently because I was coming a little late to the party. I hadn't realized that you had decided to walk away from your quote-unquote formal professional connections to basketball. And you said to me, my 52-year relationship with basketball is over. So that by itself begs to tell a story. So before we get into Van Wert AAU and AYBT and all the things that maybe are the identifiers for a lot of people for you, where's your basketball story start?
Well, I was born in 1955, which was back in the dark ages. I grew up at the Vanwood County Jail. My dad was a sheriff of Vanwood County at that time. I don't know if you knew that or not.
I had heard that recently, but I didn't know it prior to now.
Yeah, so from 1955 to 1969, my brothers and I lived at the county jail. And, like, our bedrooms were separated from the cell blocks by just a thin wooden door back then, which usually wasn't locked. So it was a great, great childhood to grow up there, but it was pretty isolated, and we didn't have a lot of friends. We didn't play sports at that age, so I really didn't get involved in basketball until I was like a sophomore in high school. I decided to try out for the JV team. Got cut, and for whatever reason, I was still interested in basketball. I still wanted to be a basketball player and continue to work at the game, and that's kind of how basketball started for me.
That might have something to do with why I think we've always kind of been kindred spirits. I got cut as a sophomore, and I got cut as a junior, too. And by that senior year, I had kind of decided maybe coaching was my avenue to stay involved.
Yeah, I think I took the same avenue. Although I played competitively for a long time. Ended up playing in college a little bit down at Wright State, Helena. And had a great experience down there. My college coach was Bill Soccer, who just passed away, I think, like last month. Had a big influence on me.
Well, so that's one name that you mentioned. Let's talk a little bit about maybe the really key influences that kind of drove you toward two things. One, just the love of basketball in general, and two, a passion for coaching the game.
As far as influences by coaches?
Yeah, or people in general.
Yeah, I really didn't have that because I wasn't involved in that area. But as I got older, I was friends with a lot of great coaches from the area, like Frank Menning and Bob Arnzen, Ray Etzler, Dick Kortocrax, Al Welch, certainly Keith Noss and Dave Frelick locally had a big influence on me, were a big help to me. But like as far as a mentor, like I'd never played sports, so I never had a coach. So when I started coaching, I didn't know what the hell I was doing. I mean, I was just pretty much playing it by ear and just kind of winging it. But I loved it, and I coached everything. I coached every sport that you can think of, basketball, football, baseball, soccer. It was an amazing time.
So when you get involved in coaching in so many different ways, would it be fair to say that your initial passion was just teaching sport and being involved in the mentorship type relationships that coaching creates, or was it really that's what you needed to do to prepare to do the basketball thing?
I would say more of just being involved. I mean, I love kids. I loved being at the YMCA, and I don't think anybody's path to becoming a coach could have been more unlikely or more improbable than mine. I mean, not only had I never had a coach, I'd never played organized sports. And I was so lucky to be involved in what I always call the golden age of youth sports, you know, back in those days. Today, youth sports is pretty much about money and lots of it, as you know. Like when I started out, the biggest investment parents made for their child's youth sports career was buying a YMCA membership, which was out of reach for even some of those parents back then. And now today, I think it's a $30 billion industry, you know, which is crazy to think about.
That is insane, actually. When you talk about starting to get into coaching and having that, what you described as the most unique route or unlikely route to coaching, did you see yourself as trying to become a head coach, a high school coach, or was it that community-based thing that was really your biggest draw?
You know, I did become a head coach, actually. I was the last head coach at Minden Union High School before they consolidated with Parkway. I mean, I was such a lousy coach, they had to consolidate to get rid of me after 1 year. But and that was a great experience down there, too. I mean, I think we won two games that year, but we had great kids and had a really good time.
Now, what? But, I mean, refresh my memory. Well, I mean, I remember Minden Union High School, but what year was the final year that Minden Union, before it consolidated with Parkway?
John, I'm thinking that was probably about 1990, maybe 1989.
I would have guessed about that time because when I was growing up at Upper Scioto Valley, about 90 was my senior year, and I remember my brother playing for Upper Scioto Valley and Doug Etzler playing for Crestview, and that was a big rivalry for a couple of years. But yeah. But it would have been 1990 that Crestview's maybe second or third best player was a Minden Union kid. I think Aaron Fry.
Aaron Fry, yeah, he played for, I think, Randy Humerkaus. Randy Humerkaus was at Minden back then.
And
our first game there at Minden, we had a home game. I think it was against Richdale, maybe. And we managed to win the game. It was the first home game our seniors had ever won. And they carried me off the floor, and some of them had tears running down their face. And it was just a great, great experience.
You know, I think what gets lost a lot of times, Jim, in the sport culture that we live in, you talk about the difference in youth sports. And I'm going to talk about a little bit of a difference in sport in general. It's always been a bottom line business, but we have reached an era when there's so much publicity on coaches and there's so much celebration of the scoreboard success, the win and loss totals. And there's so many great ones in that area from our area here in Northwestern, West Central Ohio, that it's really easy, I think, for people to say, well, if you didn't win a lot of games, then you weren't doing a good job as a coach. And I would venture to say, and my belief is this, that for as many guys as we've got from the Bob Arnsons, Bob Sagersons, Dick Quartercrackses, you know, the 300, 400, 500, 600, 700 game winners, we got an awful lot of very similar people in a different vein, in that they're getting blood out of turnips, man. They're squeezing everything that they can get out of their kids, and it might be that 2 wins, 3 wins, 6 wins, 8 wins is a remarkable coaching job, and it never seems to get recognized. So I'm glad you mentioned that, because when you say it was a good experience, you know, the reason I shut the podcast down was for a while was to go coach high school, and we went 3-18 or 3-19 or whatever we went, and I'm here to tell you that was a good experience, and what we did was really positive, almost across the board. Not, you know, understanding that there was just big talent gaps, and we got destroyed a few nights. But overall, I felt like our coaching staff and our players really did a lot of great things in a year that nobody is going to characterize as a success. So when you describe that night for you at Minden Union, it strikes a chord with me, to be sure.
John, we won 2 games that year, and we were darn lucky that we had to go to Bettsville, which is, I know, 3 or 4 hours from Minden just to get that second win. But once we got to about Christmas, I realized that team was not going to – we were in the MAC. They were not going to win any games. So my goal from Christmas on was just to have as much fun as we could have, and we did. And I think it was a great experience for those boys, and I'm still in contact with a lot of them to this day.
So when you reflect on that and that coming to a close, was there a moment in time or a brief segment of your life after that ended when you felt like maybe – you wouldn't be involved in basketball, or did you develop a kind of a plan for a plan B? That's the phrase I like to use a lot. Was there a plan B that became readily obvious to you?
I was coaching seventh grade basketball at Van Wert the same year, and I had a big meeting with Keith Noss and the principal at Van Wert Middle School. I mean, they couldn't believe that I could do both, and they did not want me to take that Minden job and coach at Van Wert. And it took a lot of convincing to get them to say, okay, you can try this, but they did not want me to dip. My son was a seventh grade job, so.
Well,
it all worked out.
I'm going to tell you that you described your journey as the most improbable journey to coaching. That's the most improbable coaching job I've ever heard of, being a head high school coach for one district and a seventh grade coach for another one. That's you've got to be one of one. I don't think there's any doubt.
Yeah, they were concerned, I will say the least. They were definitely concerned.
So your connection to Van Wert then has been a longstanding one. We're talking about more than 30 years that your connection to Van Wert basketball per se has been established. When was the kind of the segue to the Van Wert quote unquote summer basketball scene, the AAU? I use AAU as a very generic term. I hope people understand that, but the summer scene and the more of that youth focus, did that develop very, very quickly after that 1990-ish time frame?
Actually, the AAU thing started in 1987. So I heard someone talk about this Junior Olympic stuff and this AAU stuff. What the hell is that? I mean, no. So I did a little investigation and saw what it was. I thought, man, it would be cool to get a bunch of kids from here in Van Wert, put a team in that. So that was when Joe Gardner and Quincy Cloud would have been seventh grade. So they were on that team. Actually, Aaron Fry, as an eighth grader, was on that team. I think Shane Boroff and Matt Kavanaugh from Crestview were on that team. So we go down to Columbus. I'm thinking, you know, well, Joe and Quincy have been undefeated for 2 years. I mean, we got a hell of a team here. We go down there, we got our doors blown off. And I mean, I got my eyes opened up to what AAU basketball is all about. I mean, I had no idea of the talent that was out there. So the next year we put together a better team. I think we were within one basket of qualifying for the Nationals. And then, of course, in 1989, we added Mike Ellison from St. Mary's, Kurt Potcotter from Salina, Andy Etzler from Crestview, Rob Welch, we added him. We qualified for the Nationals in Las Vegas and went out there and we finished sixth out of 64 teams. And that was back in the day when there was just one national tournament. I mean, you had to qualify in your state to get to go to a national tournament. Today, you can play in a national tournament in Convoy on Friday and play another one on Saturday. I mean, they're prolific. But back then, there was just one.
So when you made that decision to get involved there and you talked about having your eyes open the way you did, who was your help? Who was guiding you through the process? Who was helping you decide on a roster? Was it you and anybody that might be willing to help, or were you able to put together a program and build a staff to do those things?
Actually, I'll tell you about a guy you probably know because you've been around a long time. I was at Bradfield Center one time. I was in a tournament down there with Quincy and Joe when they were in sixth grade. And there was a junior high coach at Salina that I didn't care much for. I thought he was kind of a jerk. And I didn't know him that well. So I'm walking out of Bradfield Center, and Bruce Stroll follows me out. You know Bruce?
I know of Bruce. I don't think we've ever actually met.
So he follows me out, and he says, hey, what's this Junior Olympic stuff I've been hearing about? So I explained it to him. He goes, yeah, that sounds like a me kind of a program. He said, you need any help? And I said, yeah, I said, sure. So he ended up helping me, and he ended up being one of the best friends of my life. And Bruce passed away in, I think, 2003, had colon cancer. But we went to Vegas together, and we just had a hoot out there.
So I'm going to ask this question really from a position of ignorance, because as new as AAU was in 1986 or 1987, it is so much a staple of the basketball culture today. When you looked into involving your teams in that, was that a situation where you guys provided the transportation cost? What were you able to provide, and what were you asking families to pay for back when this first got started?
There was no cost. If there's any cost, I pay for it. No kid ever paid to play for me back in those days. I paid for everything. We got brand new uniforms, and we raised money, of course, to fly out to Vegas. As far as charging kids to play, I wasn't a big fan of that.
And you, to be clear here, now I'm saying this somewhat tongue in cheek. You weren't getting any money from Adidas or Nike or Under Armour.
I never made a dime from basketball for 20 years. I mean, until I got involved with AYBT, that's the first money I ever made from basketball. And I coached year round for 20 years for free.
Well, and I hope that somebody has told you if they haven't, you need to hear that. That's the part of it that's the most important to me. I mean, I have no problem with people that monetize every avenue that they can. You and I were talking before we started recording the podcast about the potential of monetizing something like this, because that's the world we live in. But I've done a lot of basketball things for free myself. I've done a lot of basketball things for very, very little money that maybe didn't even cover the cost of the transportation to and from the things that I was doing. And probably the reason that I did, at least initially, was I got my start in a program like the one that you offered. So I would like to talk a little bit about that, because after you get that thing established for 2 or 3 years, you know, AAU went from being something that was brand new to something that a lot of people wanted to be involved in. When did you start to branch into multiple age groups and that kind of stuff?
Well, it exploded. I mean, once we had that success out there, I mean, no one had ever heard of it here. I mean, it was brand new. We were the first team to ever go to a national tournament. And when we got back home, man, it was headlines in our local paper. And then, like, the next year, we had two or three teams, and then three or four teams, and then they started sprouting up all over the place. So, I mean, it just really snowballed. And I did that for probably did AAU for 5 or 6 years, I would say. We went to three national tournaments during that span.
That's not a bad percentage to go. When you said you had to qualify for those tournaments. But I know you may remember this and I don't, so if you can help me clarify it, but you talk about it exploding, because I remember in 1980, maybe 87, 88, 89, I remember Lima having some pretty good AAU teams that got going, and I know Doug and some of those guys played in Lima and ended up in the Nationals. You're talking only, though, am I correct? We're only talking about maybe a 2 or 3 year window from no AAU in our area to two of the better programs in the state being right here in Van Wert and Lima.
Right. And people need to understand that the national tournaments in AAU was just one age group. Like when you went to Las Vegas, it was only 14 year olds there. There were 64 14 year old teams there, and they're the best teams in the country because there is no place else to go. You know, today you might get three states represented in a national tournament. I mean, they're not really national tournaments, but they call them. That's why they can charge more money, I think. But back in that day, I mean, everybody was there.
So
the team we lost to in Las Vegas actually had a point guard by the name of Jock Bond, who is now the head coach of the New Jersey Nets.
Yeah, absolutely.
And he was pretty good.
He wasn't bad. Wasn't bad. An LA kid.
Yeah, he was pretty good.
Nice little career at Kansas. Nice long career in the NBA, and obviously has turned it into a career in coaching. So we could probably build an entire podcast episode around those types of stories. The people that you crossed paths with, the teams that you competed with. If you had to, and I don't like to put people on the spot, but if you had to identify, let's say, maybe the most memorable opponent that you got a win over on a stage like that, who would it have been and what was the story like?
You know, I really didn't know the teams out there, like in Las Vegas, you mean?
Yeah, or anyone on your way there. I mean, did you play in other states on your way to Vegas? Was it just playing around here and then playing in Vegas when it first started? How did you get from Van Wert, Ohio to qualifying for events in Vegas? And what types of talent were you competing against in Vegas for sure, but even on your way there?
Well, you had to compete. You had to qualify either in Columbus or Cleveland. That's the only two places you could qualify to. So we went to Columbus. We qualified down there. We actually finished second. And the team that finished third was from Columbus, Brookhaven. And they had a player by the name of Charles Henley, who went on to play football at Kansas and played in the NFL for, I think, St. Louis Rams, maybe.
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
But he stole the ball from Rob Welch 3 or 4 times in that game. And Frank Manning looked at me and said, anybody who can steal the ball from Rob Welch, we need to see if he'll go to Vegas with us. So his parents and they decided to go. And his parents were just sweet and wonderful people. And like out in Vegas, John, like I'm sitting over there, I'm coaching this team, and I'm looking across in the stands. And in the stands, I got Ray Esler, Frank Manning, and Hal Welch. You know, I mean, I'm as nervous as I can be. I'm sweating bullets. I'm like, what am I doing over here? I got three Hall of Fame coaches over there watching me, but they were fantastic. They never once interfered or tried to tell me how to do anything. They just supported the team, and that was it.
So let's talk a little bit about that aspect of it. Once you get to the level where you know you're going to be playing on some big stages against high-level competition, did you have go-to people? Did you have resources that you went to try and develop more of your coaching philosophy, your style of play, offensive things, defensive things? I would imagine that there were just as many resources available to you then that there are now, but it was a little bit of a different time back then than it is now. How did you develop the way that you wanted to play with your guys, and how did you go about, literally coaching the game of basketball?
Well, I would have to give Keith Noss most of the credit for that, because most of the things that I did were things that he did and he believed in. Guy Neal was a part of the program back then too. And I ran Keith's offense for 30 years. I could run that in my sleep. Every kid that ever went to Van Wert could run that off. I think you talked about that with maybe Coach Fraley one time.
Yeah, I sure did. Yep.
I pretty much did what Keith ran, and he was a big help back then. But yeah, we always played man-to-man. We liked to press. We liked to run and jump, you know, all that good stuff.
And that might be a good topic to kind of latch onto. It seems to me, if I remember right, that in that mid to late 80s time frame, and it might have been maybe some of the Patino influence, but it feels like a lot more teams wanted to play that way in the late 80s through the mid 90s, and now it's very, very rare that you, except for on the summer circuits. It feels like summer basketball is still driven by a lot of teams that want to pick up full court pressure and play really, really fast.
Yeah, and high school teams just don't do that. I mean, they really don't, especially around here in Northwest Ohio. I mean, nobody presses.
And what do you attribute that to, that kind of the changeover? Because I don't think a ton of teams pressed even in Northwest Ohio back in that late 80s to mid 90s, but more did than do today, certainly. And there were some programs that were kind of built on it. What do you attribute that change to? Why do you think that we've seen less and less of that?
I think it's just a philosophy that goes back, you know, 50, 60 years. I mean, that's Crestview, for instance. I mean, Crestview plays a certain way. They've always played that way, and they've always won 15 games every year. Doesn't matter who's coaching there. I mean, it's just, I think it's just ingrained. Vanworth's never been a pressing team.
Did you have
maybe Lima Senior?
Right, sure. Did you have any inclination with the guys that you were coaching that style of play was more appealing to them when they got to the summer and that's how they were going to play?
I know kids like to play that way, you know, and I like to play that way. I like to get as many shots as you can get in the 40 minutes that you're out there. So, I mean, we like to get shots up quick. And I mean, I love trapping and pressing, and that's just how AAU is. I mean, it's still that way.
Yeah, there's no doubt. I mean, you don't have to watch very much of it to see that. When you went through that experience, particularly the really high levels of success, talk a little bit, if you would, about maybe when that started to change a little bit, or what made the change, that just the number of events that you were participating in or the number of options that were available. Was it more and more difficult to field teams, or was it, I guess the way I would look at it is there were either kids going and doing other things or trying to play for other teams, or were you guys still kind of able to choose the cream of the crop for about as long as you wanted to?
Yeah, it actually only lasted maybe 2 or 3 years. And then I remember the first time that someone stole one of my players, and which had never happened to me before. And I just got a bad feeling about that, you know, about AAU in general. And I was making my exit plan at that point, and thank God AYBT came along and I was able to do something else. But I just didn't like the way AAU operated.
So that's a good place for I've been kind of trying to find a place to fit this question in. I mean, in general, it's fair to say that AAU is a fairly polarizing topic in the basketball community. There are people who believe in it wholeheartedly. There are people that are very suspect about it. In some ways, even cynical about it. You've experienced some of things that you would describe as negative, I guess. In general, when you look at what AAU was when you first got involved and what you see of it today, is there still positive to be gained in terms of positive outweighing negative, or do you feel like it's lost a lot of that value?
Well, yeah, I think kids are now playing longer for their AAU teams than they play for their school teams. You know, I mean, the travel basketball season now is like 5 months long. You know, I think AAU coaches have more influence on high school kids than their high school coaches do. I just don't think that's right. I've never believed in that. I always thought the high school season should be your main focus.
You know,
I don't think that's the case today.
I think you're absolutely right. I think all you'd have to do is talk to one or two coaches, college coaches at the high major levels, that would tell you that they are far more interested in having a relationship with the AAU coach than they are the high school coach. And I'm not going to go all in on whether that's really bad, but I will say this. I just saw yesterday, it's funny you should bring that up. I just saw yesterday scrolling through Twitter, and I don't know who the guy is, and I'm not going to give his name here anyway, because I don't want him to have any kind of platform. But he had tweeted out a very sarcastic and frustrated tweet about the evaluation period starts in less than 7 days, and some of these kids are still practicing and still playing with their high school coaches. Can't you just shut yours down so they can have this time for the evaluation period? And I could not believe, like, and then the comment that was after that was, hey, this is our high school program, and you're getting the entire month of July for most high school coaches. And he said, hey, I don't care how often they play for their high school team in the summer. I just want to be able to have AAU time in January and February too. Are they going to give me that? And I was blown away by that comment. I think there are really good coaches in every realm of basketball, and I think there are less than stellar human beings in every realm of basketball. So I'm not pigeonholing AAU into any single category, but I think what you described about the first experience in 1987 and what we know about AAU today is that it's just grown to a place where it doesn't feel to me like it has a nice niche in the basketball world. It's like everybody's trying to fit around AAU, and I think it should be the other way around.
John, when I started, AAU season was March, April, and May. Now it's March, April, May, June, July. Why do you think that they extended it into June and July? You think it's because of the development of the kids, or you think it's because of the money?
Amen.
What's the money?
Yeah.
I mean, it's the money. They used to let the high school teams have their team and leave them alone. Now it's 5 years. I would love to see the high school coaches take the teams back from the AAU teams in June and July, start building a relationship with their kids in the summer, and build a foundation for February and March. But they don't do it.
Well, you're preaching to the choir. I wholeheartedly agree with you. And believe it or not, we're coming up on a half an hour. So I think it's a good point to maybe take a quick break, and we can talk about your exit from AAU and the kind of the evolution of AYBT. I think that's going to be a great way to spend the last half of our pod.
Okay, sounds good.
All right, we'll take a quick break. I just want to take a quick second and interrupt the podcast for a minute to remind you that our new platform for the podcast is Spotify for Podcasters. And if you're listening on Spotify, you have an opportunity to make a donation to the podcast if you would be inclined to do so. Thanks for considering any sort of donation. One-time, monthly, or other regular donations are certainly welcome. Spotify for Podcasters is our platform, and they're providing an easy option for you to do so just by clicking the link at the end of the episode. Thanks for your consideration, and now back to the podcast. All right, Jim. So you mentioned it before we got into that discussion about the downside of AAU. You had said after 2 or 3 years, you were looking for your exit strategy away from AAU, and AYBT was kind of a godsend to you. So for our listeners who might not be familiar with the concept of AYBT, share that with them, and then your exposure to it and your beginning to get involved in AYBT and what it meant to you.
Well, John, actually started in 1993, and it was called NAYB. There was an organization in Wisconsin called North American Youth Basketball. I saw a little one-inch by one-inch ad in the Lima News that said, make a living doing basketball or be a director or whatever, call this number. So I called this guy out there, and he told me what he did, and then he said, here's what you can do. And I said, great, I'd love to do it. That's right up my alley. He said, well, you got to come out here and do an interview. The guy was in Oshkosh, Wisconsin. So I drove all the way out to Oshkosh and met with a guy. And of course, he gave me the Vanward District, which he would have done anyway, I'm sure. So I come back home. I'm all excited. I recruit 6 teams. You know, we're ready to play in the national tournament out there in Wisconsin. And we're getting ready to get hotels. And this guy says, well, you got to get hotels in our dorms. And I'm like, well, what's that about? He's like, well, that's just the deal. You got to stay in the dorms if you want to do the tournament. Well, the dorms have no air conditioning. And you had to go down the hall to go to the bathroom, no private bathroom. And they're like, John, well, I'm not having my grandparents go down the hall in the middle of the night to use the restroom. So long story short, I recruited these teams. We played a local tournament. We never did go to NAYB. But then there were some other guys who were there at NAYB and thought they could do a better job. And there was 13 of them, and they formed an American Youth Basketball Tour. And that's how that got started. And a guy in Michigan named Bob Renwick, who was the head of that, somehow got my name and phone number. He called me one night. He said, hey, Clay, so I got this deal. So we want to start up this American Basketball. We want you to be a director down there. I said, Bob, I've already done that with NAYB. NAYB was a disaster. I don't want any part of it. Said goodbye. A week later, he calls me a second time, has another spiel. He tries to talk me into it. I said, no, I'm just not interested. I don't want to do that. I mean, like, if someone told me no twice, I would never call them a third time. You're probably the same, but Renwick called me a third time, and I said, I'll tell you what I'm going to do, Bob. I'll run one tournament, and that's it. I'm not promising you anything else. So he recruited one team out of Toledo for me. It wasn't in my district, but he didn't have a director, so he had a team out there, and he gave it to me. I got $300 for that team. I ended up running the tournament. At the end of the day, I made $3,000, which is more money I'd ever made in a week in my life. And I thought, you know, this is something I think I can do, you know. So the following year, I signed up 17 teams. The year after that, 36, then 51, then 100. Then my high was 150. I was the most successful director in the history of American youth basketball. Made a lot of money and had a lot of great experiences. That's how it started.
Well, and I think it's a fascinating thing because I think it can't be drastically different for you than it was for me. Like we've been brought up and told, find something you would do for free and then find a way to get paid for it. I mean, I've heard that
Right.
expression so many times in my life, and coaching was something I would have done for free. I did it for free as a kid. I did it for free as a college student. I did it for free in a lot of ways, but when you can find a way to get paid for it, that's then it doesn't feel like work. But very, very few people get the experience of shouldering an organization like you had in AAU and transitioning to something different where it becomes actually lucrative for you. And I think that's something you should be commended for. And I, for one, am really happy that you got to have that experience. But it's also something, Jim, that when you did it, even though you were, making money doing it, I felt like, and I was, I think, blessed to put teams into your events. You tried really hard to be accommodating to people and to be available to them in the midst of whatever the scheduling situations might be, or teams that didn't show up. And that was the one thing that stood out to me and appealed to me about AYBT was, it wasn't a nameless and a faceless event. I knew I would have contact with somebody that I had a relationship with that would be trying to serve the interests of all the teams there, not just the interest of we've got as many teams as we can have here and now we've made the money we need to make. And that was the part I appreciated. I don't know how many other guys you were involved with in that. I don't know how that philosophy evolved or if that was just your way of doing business, but it was really appreciated on my end.
Well, and I always appreciated having you there. And there was no place I would rather be. I mean, that's where I felt most at home was on a basketball court, as you do as well.
Oh, there's no doubt. And that was, I think, the thing that I always appreciated. Now, you said about 1993. So kind of take us through, I guess, the evolution of it for you from 93 on forward into that maybe early 2000s time frame, the growth of AYBT and also some of the relationships that you created as a result and how the organization itself grew.
Yeah, well, AYBT actually started in 1995, and I took a team to the national tournament, which at that point was down in Bloomington. Bloomington had a great facility, had about 10 courts down there in one room. It wasn't air conditioned, it was a hot box in the summer. Have you ever been down there?
Years ago, it wasn't 95, but it wasn't long after that.
It was hot. I mean, you just sweat just standing there, but. And I took a bunch of teams down there, and we went to Bloomington, I suppose 5 or 6 years. And then I heard about the Spieth Fieldhouse in Fort Wayne. I went and checked that out. That was fantastic. I told the administration, I said, we got to move this up to Fort Wayne. I said, it'll grow our league, and it'll be a great thing for us. And we did. And we were, I think our Nationals had like 400 teams at one time at Fort Wayne. But as the AAU club started to grow, AYBT started to die because AYBT was basically invented for school teams. When you get an AAU club coming into Van Wert and they're taking the two best teams from Van Wert 7th grade and the two best teams from Lincoln View 7th grade and the two best from Crestview 7th grade, well, guess what? Nobody wants to coach them other kids because the two best kids were gone. So school basketball in the summer died, started to die at that point. And now it's totally dead. There is no summer school basketball anymore that I know of.
No, so I guess I hadn't really been completely aware of that. I just remember that the AYBT events that I was involved in, I felt like I could put together the kind of team you just described. I wasn't going to have the two best seventh graders or eighth graders or ninth graders from any one school. I was going to have maybe the kids that were a notch below that, but I could take the kids that were a notch below that, put them together, practice with them, get them better, and find a really good place to compete. And so if it started out as a school-based thing and eventually that evolved or I guess devolved, really kind of disappeared, were you intentionally targeting that notch below AAU, or did it just naturally evolve that people, were looking for a place to play competitively without getting run over?
Yeah, I think it was for B-level teams. Like in the 30 years I was involved, I don't think I saw two or three elite basketball teams or kids that were going to play Division I basketball. But there was a lot more bad basketball players in the world than there are good basketball players. I think we figured that out a long time ago, but they all love to play. And so that was kind of our niche.
Well,
then they just stopped playing.
It was a remarkably welcome niche for a guy like me. Like I said, I don't have any ill will toward the high level AAU stuff. I just, the kids that I was going to coach weren't going to be that kind of kid, and they were going
to
be kids.
You couldn't have taken your teams to those big high power tournaments.
No, and I still had kids that absolutely loved basketball, absolutely wanted the summer to be a time of development. And really, probably the second or third time I got involved in it, my son, who's now 20, was probably a seventh or an eighth grader. And we decided to put a team together. And I coached the team with a friend of mine and basically said to the guys that came in, look, we're doing this so we can be in the gym, so you can work at your game and get better, so that you can build relationships with kids from other schools. And, you know, the great thing about it is after one or two of your events, for a couple summers in a row, the third summer, my son and I were asked to go to another organization for him to play and me to be one of the coaches at another organization. And I was really seriously considering it because it was going to be a step up and it was going to be somebody else handling a lot of the organizational stuff and I could just coach. And my son said to me, like, I just want to stay with what we're doing because I really like our guys. And you know, look, we went to your events and still didn't barely finish 500. But what we wanted out of basketball for the summer, we were able to get and be competitive. And without your avenue, we wouldn't have had that. There's no way.
Yeah, and it was like a family reunion. Our events were like family reunions. I mean, people would be grilling out. I mean, people would bring a bus load of people and stay at the motels and party all night. Everybody knew everybody. It was just a great experience. We had tournaments with 120, 130 teams in them at one time.
And you eventually, and there were other directors that were kind of underneath you. I know that there was an event in Findlay that we played every year for 3 or 4 years. And was it Eric?
Eric Freisinger, yep.
Eric was up there in Findlay. And again, only met Eric because of the events. But I hope you appreciate this. I hope it resonates with you when I say that when I met Eric and participated in his events, it felt like somebody had cloned Jim Clay and put him in charge of an event, from the availability and the communication and the service to our teams and our kids. And whether or not that just happened to be the luck of the draw, or whether or not you guys were able to work and foster relationships that resulted in that, again, the product that was AYBT, to me, was at least the standard was teams are going to be well served and going to be cared for and taken care of and treated with respect. And you did it, and Eric did it in spades. When was the beginning for you to start feeling like maybe this thing might be winding down? I mean, it was a long run, and AYBT was really good for a lot of people, and obviously it was very good for you. When did you start to have a feeling that it might be coming to a close?
About 5 or 6 years ago, I was at Ohio Northern, and I was just walking through, and I heard a couple of guys talk. And I heard one guy say, "Yeah, I heard AYBT was dying." And then, like that's the first I'd heard anything like that. So I just kind of took a look at things. I thought, you know, this guy might be. I mean, it's shrinking, and they eventually shrank to nothing. Like my last tournament was in Salina 2 weekends ago. We had 4 teams down there.
Yeah,
and that was lucky to have them.
Sure, no kidding. No kidding. So,
people are all jacked up about this exposure stuff, you know, which I've railed about this forever. I mean, it's just a phony word, a phony made up word. Like you come to the term, you're going to get exposed. There's going to be college coaches looking at you. You're going to get a college scholarship. I mean, that just doesn't happen. I mean, it's just a way to charge more money to parents who can't afford it.
And Jim, I'm not here to tell you that I don't think exposure is necessary for some kids, but I will say this. And there are always going to be exceptions to every rule, but did you know Dave Isle when he was at Allen East High School?
Dave Isle?
Yeah.
I don't think so.
He coached at Allen East in the late 80s, probably mid to late 80s. I think he left there in 1990. And Dave used to say to the guys that played for him at Allen East, and he had some pretty good players. I mean, he had a run of, I think when he was there in 86 to 90, it was the only time in the history of the school at that point that they had 5 straight seasons of 500 or better. But, you know, he had a Division I football player in James Patton who played for him, and some pretty good athletes. And he he used to say to his guys, and I heard it through, you know, through being around his guys, if you can play, they're going to find you.
Like, I've always said that.
I mean, there's in this day and age, especially, I mean, how does somebody hide? How does a good player hide? It can't be done.
With social media and all that, I mean, did they find him 25 years ago? I mean, yeah, they found him.
No question.
I mean, parents just need to realize you don't have to spend all that money for your kids to do all that. I mean, it's just unnecessary. It's the YMCA. Work hard on your game. Get better. You'll get all the exposure you need during your high school season.
Well, you've brought things kind of full circle for me for this next question. So when you start feeling like over a 5 or 6 year window of time that, and you're watching it kind of dwindle to the point where it's not really going to be your livelihood for a lot longer. You know, was it a instant decision at the end of this last run? Was it, hey, here's my plan of I've got 2 or 3 more years to go. And what's your involvement? I mean, you said your relationship with basketball is going to end after 50 years. You and I both know that's not going to happen. It's not going to end entirely. Are you still involved with the Van Wert Y? And are you still able to be involved in some sort of activity with the youth and basketball in that realm that you started in?
The best thing that ever happened to me, I mean, the best thing is the live streaming of high school basketball and JV basketball and freshman basketball during the winter on Friday and Saturday nights. And I cannot wait to watch games on TV because I hate going to games, but I still love high school basketball. I probably watched every Vanguard freshman game. So that's been a lifesaver. I can sit here and have a beer and watch some good high school basketball.
Is it a little bit difficult for you to not get into the gyms as often as maybe you'd like to?
Oh, I'm sure. Yeah, I played competitive basketball for 27 years. I coached probably over 2,000 games. I ran sporting events for 40 years. I mean, being in a gym with the game I love was just as natural as breathing for me. You know, I mean, basketball and I went everywhere together back in the day, but it's always been my safe space and where I felt most at home. But as I've gotten older, I felt kind of awkward and out of place. You know, it's just time to move on.
Yeah,
unfortunately.
Well, you mentioned that. I think that's the natural progression of as you age. This everything changes, and the way they do the game changes. The way they do the game changes. The way the game gets coached, officiated. The way fans are. I mean, everything about it changes. But you and I were talking during the break before we started recording again that, you know, I am a guy who. I guess maybe I'm even a little bit sappy because the game is the most important part. And if it's good for the game, I don't even have to be a fan of the way things are going. If it's good for the game, I'm a fan of it. I've used this example lots of times. Like at my core, I'm a guy that grew up in the 1980s and got into coaching in the 1990s and the 2000s. So I've watched a lot of evolution, but at my core, I'm a guy that likes to, I would love to say, hey, we're gonna play some high low basketball. And we're gonna play inside out, play through our post guys, and you know, and we're gonna build an offense around getting good looks because we're good in the paint. And it feels like the 3-point line gets treated like a three second lane in basketball today. But in general, I think it's opened up the game. It's made the game a little more exciting for a lot more people to watch. So even though it might not be the way I do it. I don't love basketball any less today than I did 25 years ago, and the game's entirely different.
John, we built the first extension onto the Vanwyr YMCA, our first big gym up there. We helped the director, Larry Bowersock, paint the lines on the court to save some money. So we wanted to paint the 3-point line, and Larry says, no, we're not painting those on here. That's just a passing fad. I think he was off on that.
Yeah, he might have missed that call.
Yeah, for sure.
So as you consider what now is officially your retirement from basketball, I guess this is maybe the hard part of the conversation is you look back on a very, very long history and you mentioned some of the guys that were influences on you. When you look back now, what are the things that maybe are the top of that list of the things you're most thankful for?
Oh, just my relationship with the kids that I coached. I mean, young coaches need to understand that you don't just coach a kid for one season. And you know this. you coach a kid for life. And if you're not prepared for that, then coaching really isn't for you. I mean, you need to work hard to create good memories for them that'll last forever. And because once your coaching days are over, the relationships you built with those kids are really all that matters. And I pray to God that I did it right when I had my chance.
And so I always ask, or generally ask this question of nearly every person that's been on the podcast, when you get the passion that basketball became for you, and I talk about the bug biting people, it's pretty nasty. I mean, it's like a drug for a lot of people. It always has been for me. What was it like for you to try and maintain that balance between, I mean, you could have done the game 24 hours a day. We all can. How did you find ways to balance what that game was and what your passion was for that, and still, you know, family life and the things that weren't directly related to the game, but were going to be impacted by all the time you spent with it?
Right. Basketball lit a fire in me that was so bright and so hot. I mean, it consumed my life for the next 50 years. I mean, I'm sure you can identify with that.
No doubt.
And it probably will for the next, you know, whatever years, but... You know, fortunately, I didn't have much of a private life or a personal life. I mean, coaching was my life. Kids were my life. That's what I did. I did it year round for 30 years. I'm not sure I'd be here today if I hadn't had that.
Well, that's a remarkable perspective. I'm sure somewhere on this planet there's somebody that either refers to you as or looks at you as a grandfather figure. In your life, if you were giving any level of direction about pursuing the game as young people get older, what might you advise them that they may not hear somewhere else?
Just, I mean, if you're passionate about the game, just work hard at it, respect it, don't take it for granted, be a good teammate, be a good person. Whether you're playing or whether you're on the bench, and you don't see a lot of that today. I mean, I always watch kids on the bench. I'm sure you do too, to see their attitudes. But I got some grandsons out there. I got two grandsons in Ohio and three in Tennessee. And I don't know if they'll be basketball players or not, but hopefully they'll grow up to be good people.
Well, and again, that's a nice segue into what might be the last question that I have, because I think it's really cliche to talk about what sports can teach you about life. I think there are a lot of people who automatically dismiss the concept because it's so cliche. But you just touched on a couple of things that I think are really, really important. No matter what your level of passion is or investment in the game is, there is, I think, almost an impossible to measure value in learning how to be a good teammate, learning how to be a coachable player, learning how to accept a role and thrive in a role, even if it's not the role that you want. And maybe there are lots of places in the world to learn that, but I'm not sure I've ever come across a better one than basketball, ever.
Oh, I would totally agree. Totally agree with that.
So before we wrap things up here, I don't like to put you on the spot, but you had rattled off the names of a lot of young men that were a part of the initial program that you started. You talked about when you coach kids, you don't just coach them for a season, you coach them for life. Can you talk a little bit about some of the young men that you did coach when they were young men that you still have communication with, or you have relationship with, maybe weddings that you've attended, or the way that you can clearly identify that you connected with a young man through the game and it's continued to be a part of your life today?
You ask good questions, you know that?
Well, I've been practicing this for a while.
John, every good friend I ever had in my life, I made through basketball. Every single one was introduced to the game of basketball. And I'm still great friends with Joe Gardner. Brandon Parton is a great friend. Corey Stenning. I'm friends with all players. I mean, like every other week, it seems like a player wants to stop here to see the U Sports Hall of Fame, which is what I call my office. And it's always great to see him. I just hope that that all my kids know that I loved them then and I love them still, and nothing will ever change. Nothing will ever change that.
Well, Jim, I don't even know that I'm going to get to conceive of what it is to end of a 52-year run of being hands-on directly involved in basketball. But you know, I've missed you for the last few summers when my son got older and the AYBT thing really wasn't something we could do. Obviously the COVID year was a whole different animal. And I just want to congratulate you on what you have done. And I want to wish you the absolute best on whatever it is that you are going to do next. And I'm praying that you stay involved in some capacity. I'm sure our paths will cross, but I'm going to tell you, I plan on being intentional about making sure we find time to get connected again here before too long.
John, I appreciate that so much. I appreciate you and everything that you do and everything that you stood for too.
Much appreciated, sir. I you mentioned Brandon. I didn't get to tell Brandon I was going to have you on. So he knows the podcast is getting cranked back up. And I thought the episode that he and I recorded back, you know, a couple of years ago was one of the better ones that we did. And Brandon and I, we've stayed in touch because of it. And he's actually kind of helping me work on a couple of more guests, but I'm hoping he'll be as pleasantly surprised as a lot of those young men will be when they get a chance to hear this and listen to it. And, I'm quite certain I'll receive feedback. And if you don't get some feedback, I'll be sure to let you know the feedback that I get, because I'm anticipating a lot of people from Northwest Ohio, particularly in that Van Wert community, are going to thoroughly enjoy getting to reflect on what your 52 years involved in this game has meant. And again, I thank you for what it meant for me. And you mentioned the relationships that you have exist because of basketball. I don't know if all mine do, but I know that all the really important ones, it's a thread there for me, and I feel fortunate to get to call you a friend. And it wouldn't be the truth if it wasn't for basketball. So that's I can definitely connect with you there and agree with you wholeheartedly. But you took the time to sit down and do this when you didn't have to, and I know it's not an easy time when you come to the end of this. So congratulations on a great run, and I really do appreciate you being a part of the podcast.
Yeah, thank you so much, John. I appreciate you.
Hi, I'm Coach John Cook, and this is the Basketball and Life Podcast. Thanks so much for tuning in and checking this one out. If you're listening on Spotify, courtesy of our platform, Spotify for Podcasters, you have the opportunity to make a donation to the podcast. If you would be inclined to do so, there's a link at the bottom of the episode that will allow you to make your donation in whatever amount you would choose to do so. If you're listening on any other platform, I just ask that you please rate, review, and subscribe, and come back anytime to check out more episodes here on the Basketball and Life Podcast.